Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1831, a young Frenchman named Alexis de Tocqueville toured the young United States, peered into its boisterous character, and wrote Democracy in America, the classic early yardstick of the country's self-understanding. In 2003, on the far side of Franco-American meltdown and cheese-eating surrender monkeys, the glamorous French intellectual Bernard-Henri Lévy was invited to repeat Tocqueville's exercise. He went to prisons and churches, Guantanamo and Las Vegas, a swingers club and the Iowa State Fair, and wrote American Vertigo. He calls it an honest song of praise. Prairie Home pundit Garrison Keillor hates it. Up next on Point, in the footsteps of Tocqueville, Bernard-Henri Lévy, and American Vertigo. Joining me now in the studio is Bernard-Henri Lévy. He's one of France's most visible writers and public intellectuals, author of dozens of books, including Who Killed Daniel Pearl and War, Evil, and the End of History. His new book is American Vertigo, Traveling America in the Footsteps of Tocqueville. Bernard-Henri Lévy, welcome. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack. Good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Lévy.
Hello.
So we should say right off the bat, it was the Atlantic that reached out to you and said, would you reprise the trip of Tocqueville? And what did you think of the offer?
At the beginning, I thought it was a joke. Me, today, putting my feet in the footsteps of Tocqueville with such great thinker, I thought really it was a joke from Colin Murphy of the Atlantic. But it was not a joke. So at the beginning, I refused, and then Colin Murphy insisted. I told him that I was accustomed to, of course, to fields, but more battlefields. He told me America might become also a sort of battlefield, in a way, political one. And at the end, I accepted, and with such a joy and such an enthusiasm.
So off you went for a year, east to west, north to south, all over the place. Describe to us how you went about this. I mean, you didn't literally follow in the footsteps of Tocqueville. The country has grown since then. You charted your own course, plus some of what he did.
Of course. I began at Tocqueville. As far as I could, of course, I was in his footsteps. I tried, for example, as you said, the commission of Tocqueville was the prisons of America. I tried myself also, like him, to go in the prisons of today, which is not the best known part of this country, and which is not the part of this country about which Americans are the most proud. So I tried to do that on his footsteps, but very soon, I obeyed to my own inspiration and to the law of the country of today, which is much more huge than at the time of Tocqueville. So I went in nearly every single state, thousands and thousands of miles, by road, because I feel that you cannot have the real feeling of this country if you don't do it physically by road, on the space. There is a sort of metaphysical experience of America, which you can only do if you do it with the feeling of the space and its immensity.
Americans know that pretty well themselves. So off you went. As you say, prisons, like Tocqueville, who was charged with, or that was his project, was visiting American prisons in 1831 when he came, though he looked much more broadly. You end up in Dealey Plaza in Dallas, Bourbon Street in New Orleans, the Gun Show, a partner swapping club in San Francisco, the Iowa State Fair, stock car race, Mount Rushmore, evangelical megachurches, Salt Lake and the Mormons, and Las Vegas and Beverly Hills and lap dancing and a brothel. You begin the book, Bernard-Henri Lévy, by acknowledging that the United States is hardly popular in France these days. You single yourself out as someone who has been sympathetic, open, even a friend of the United States. How did you understand yourself coming into this project?
A Frenchman who loves America.
the Frenchman who loves America. Singular. The Frenchman who loves America. You have him in front of him. You found him, my dear Tom. No, I'm joking, but I think the best definition would be the one which Adam Gopnik from The New Yorker gave once. He qualified, he defined me as an anti-American. It does not mean that I am pro-American. I'm not a fanatic. You know, there are a lot of dark sides in this country, and I survey them at length in the book. There are parts of the book about death penalty, which I don't praise. It's the least I can say. About Guantanamo, which is for me unworthy of American democracy and so on, but I am anti-American because there is in my country and not only in my country, all over the world, a sort of hatred of principle, not for what America does, but for what America is. And this, for me, is a form of hatred of democracy also. It's a very complex thing in my country, and I fight against this, and my American vertigo is my way to pay homage to the great America of the fathers and so on, and to fight against anti-Americanism.
There's so much to look at here. Jack, I wish you'd just get in our ear a little bit about the Tocqueville that this is all modeled on. Bernard-Henri Lévy comes and finds American vertigo here. We'll ask him about that and the kickback that he's gotten here for the criticism that this is kind of a freak show tour. But when you look back on the original, the Tocqueville, his journey, his impact, Jack, how do you see it?
Well, you know, if he had come here 10 years earlier, he could have called the book Aristocracy in America. America had what would people call a deference democracy there, where great men, the local squires, pretty much told people how to vote.
At the beginning of the 19th century, then.
That's right. And not many did vote. There were property qualifications in voting. In the 1824 election, only 26% of the people voted. In 1828, that doubled to 56%. Why? Well, because, as a Jacksonian put it, it is a great contest between aristocracy and democracy. Aristocracy being John Quincy Adams representing the old country, and the new represented by Andrew Jackson on the other side. And when Jackson, who won a popular majority vote of 56%, that was the highest of the century, when Jackson took office, he said, the majority is to govern. So Tocqueville comes to this country just when that principle is suddenly been ratified for the first time. And what he sees is equality of condition, that democracy is a social principle, not just voting, that people are on the same level. There's no aristocratic rank. And the implication of equality, strangely enough, is a word that he coined, individualism. People refer, there's no authority to say what people should do. They refer them their actions to their own opinions, and they guide themselves. And this individualism, he thought, was something Americans had learned to contain its anarchic potential. They'd learned to contain through what he called self-interest rightly understood. He said the Americans were able to suspend getting everything they want for the sake of the whole. And that he feared that when that went, if Americans lost that, then they would lose, then they would really become a society of a lonely crowd, people isolated in themselves alone, and the public realm left to what he called a soft despotism.
So there are a lot of promise in his description of America, but that warning as well. Bernard-Henri Lévy comes in 2003, and you come away with a book not called American Democracy, but American Vertigo. What's the vertigo?
The question first, I was just listening. The question is to know if in 10 years from ahead from today, I hope that I would not have written a tyranny in America. You know, aristocracy in America 10 years before Tocqueville. I hope it would not be tyranny in America within 10 years. This is the first point I wanted to say. I listened to that so carefully. So many points of Tocqueville are still valid today, and especially this topic about individualism, this sense of freedom, this youthful and vibrant optimism, which is part of American spirit and which is just as alive today as it was at the time of Tocqueville. If I had to stress the differences, maybe one. Tocqueville feared the risk of a tyranny of the majority. Mm-hmm. Maybe today you are facing another risk, similar tyranny of the minorities, which works in the same way, but which could be very offending also for the definition of the individuals and so on. About the religion, Tocqueville, as you know, stressed, made a big point about the role of the religions in America and about the articulation between faith and freedom, which is still true, except that you have a new phenomenon, which I studied at length, these new mega churches like Willow Creek near Chicago, which might introduce new data in the old problem of pointed out by Tocqueville.
But vertigo means topsy-turvy, in a whirl, maybe out of control. Is that what you found in the United States, 2003?
Vertigo, what I mean by that is a crisis of identity here in this country, feeling of being at a crossroads, not knowing exactly where you are going ahead, what will happen, what is this manifest destiny of America, of which American people is with legitimacy so proud, there is a doubt about it today. So when you have a doubt, when you have a vertigo, you hold on to railings. I felt today the vertigo and the railings which
something
are
a guard, something to hang on to. Yes,
a safeguard, which are the American values, the old values of the Pilgrim Fathers, Founding Fathers, and the great presidents you had in the past, Mr. Roosevelt, Mr. Kennedy, and maybe also Mr. Clinton. So vertigo and railing.
You know, the criticism that's coming toward the book is that you presented the United States as a kind of a freak show, that if you're the friend of America, this is kind of damning with strange praise from brothels and lap dances in the Mall of America. What was most important to you in this journey? What did you see? What were the conversations you had that you found the most compelling, the most illuminating?
Surely not the brothel. There is, of course, this scene, this moment in the bordello of Nevada. It belongs to America. America is also that. Of course, Guantanamo. I had the chance to go inside Guantanamo, to spend some days in Guantanamo. So I relate that precisely. I say what happened really there and why Guantanamo is a shame on my point of view and at least unworthy of American democracy. It is also the situation. You cannot hide it. You cannot do as if you had not Puritanism and as if you had not Patriot Act and Guantanamo in America. But it was not the most impressive moment of my journey. Of course not. The most impressive moment was, for example, a conversation with the mother of a young soldier dead in Iraq and who moved me nearly to tears for two reasons. Number one, because she was so consistent in explaining that the death of her son has no meaning, has no sense. She told me also... It was a heartbreaking moment. I don't want to speak again on radio of that. It was a heartbreaking moment. Mm. I had also very impressive meetings, for example, with the widow of a coal miner of Wisconsin, who taught me so much about dignity, courage, optimism, trying to do her life, trying to survive in such great difficulties. All these are the great moments of my journey, not the freaks and the fascists.
But they're there, and they're there aplenty. Garrison Keillor says there's nobody here who you'd recognize in more than 300 pages. Nobody tells a joke. Nobody does much work. Nobody sits and eats and enjoys their food.
Nobody tells a joke except some of them, and precisely President Bush. There is a scene, a scenery. There is a portrait of President Bush, which is called, the chapter is entitled, The Revenge of the Little Man. Mm. Maybe Mr. Garrison Keillor did not read it, but there are jokes, Bush jokes. Maybe those jokes don't make him laugh. They make me laugh, in a way. The Revenge of the Little Man. Yeah. No, there are jokes in the book.
Jack Beatty, I don't want to be stuck on Garrison Keillor, but it is funny to come as a Frenchman, you write about America, and then to get such a kind of kick in the pants by, I don't know, the guy who we might call the Mark Twain of the 21st century, if we've got anything that close,
of the heart. So much of that?
Well,
Mark Twain?
Maybe not so much, but certainly a voice straight from that heartland. And Jack, it's all about this, hey, you're not giving the ordinary sort of strong fabric of America image here. You're giving a freak show.
Well, of course, Garrison Keillor has created this mythology. He's this, he's, you know, he has his little hometown up there, and he has his purchase on the American myth. He's got his angle. And this rebutting of foreigners, this goes way back. Twain himself savagely attacked Matthew Arnold, who wrote a book about America, for daring to come over here and poach on what Twain thought was his territory. You know, we don't like to hear ourselves returned by foreigners. There was a great resentment of this in the 19th century. And when Dickens came over here, everywhere he went, people kept saying to him, well, you like us, don't you? You find us acceptable, don't you? And he didn't dare say the opposite. And so Tocqueville was, he was touching on something very delicate there. People knew they were rude. They knew that in a certain sense the spirit of the country, its physical primitiveness had entered into them, and they didn't want to be judged by European standards. They wanted lenity, and they got it from Tocqueville. He, in some ways, said the best of them. He saw two huge exceptions, however. One, the condition of African American slaves, and nothing caught that condition more poignantly than an interview he had with a slaveholder who had fathered his own slaves and who was dying and now facing the certainty that his black sons would be sold into down the river by his white sons. And that moral corruption, that wickedness, caught slavery. The other exception, he called it the monstrous exception, the road through which aristocracy can enter again, was the division of labor and manufacturing between the owner and the worker. The worker narrowed every day by the narrowness of his task, the man disappearing into the job, the manufacturer, on the other hand, having his whole life stimulated by broad prospects. In other words, he saw class differences as the great threat to American equality.
So there's Tocqueville. He was amazingly just, 25 or 26 at the time. Now Bernard-Henri Lévy is here, and we want to learn what you've learned. Take a sort of step-by-step here. Megachurches. You went to a big one that you describe outside of Chicago. It's a big American phenomenon these days, many Americans attending such churches. What did you, our French friend, learn there?
I learned that something is really happening there, which is not only a religious revival. I believe that in those, and I demonstrate that in those megachurches, it is somewhat a new religion, a new form of religion which appears. In one word, the old monotheistic religions were based on the simple idea of the distance of God, a God who speaks and who keeps silent, a God which is inside us and which is outside us, a God which incarnates in our bodies and who is very far away at the same time. This was the paradox of old monotheism. In these megachurches, what I observed and what I relate is that you have a God who speaks all the time. You have a God who keeps never silent. You have a God who is here with the faithful, with the worshipper, in every single moment of the life, in the kitchen when he cooks his eggs and bacon, in his garden when he cuts his lawn, in his bed when he sleeps or does something else. A God which is absolute presence. And this old paradox of old religion, Jew, Christian, Catholic, Protestant, which is mysterium, light and darkness, light and mysterious, is completely broken by this new pattern and this new phenomenon. The God of the megachurches, I would say, is transformed into a sort of good American guy, a best buddy, your best friend. It's something new.
And the French intellectual's response, this is good, this is bad, you're indifferent?
I think it is not good. I think that there was, in the old times, till recently, a real link, a real marriage, as Tocqueville said, between faith and freedom. America was the very country where the two went the same pace and the same speed. Because of this dialectical relationship I was just telling about 1 minute ago. With this new pattern, I think that the old link between faith and freedom could be broken. And this happens in those mega churches. That is why I spend so much time and I spend so many pages of American Vertigo to try to explain what is really existing there. Moreover, mega churches. Are they still churches? Sometimes they look like banks. Sometimes
a
they
bank,
look like bank, yeah, like rock star big halls.
You have
some preachers who act as musicians.
I
saw a preacher who every two sentences spoke about his number one bestseller list in the New York Times book.
He spoke
about his hairdresser, who was the same as the hairdresser of Barbara Streisand.
Same as Barbara Streisand, and that must be a good one, Jack.
I'm sure he's a good one.
But Henri, Tocqueville would look at those churches and say, my gosh, this is the genius of America, a voluntary organization, a group of people who come together and, by coming together, overcome their sense of powerlessness in this society of individuals. And, of course, the megachurch increasingly performs the functions of society. There are daycares. There are school. There are teams. There are trips and so on. You're looking at it too narrowly. Tocqueville would have seen this as exactly what he thought was one of the ways in which Americans could keep their freedom through the exercise of voluntary organization.
Democracy in action here?
Not only. I think that Monsieur de Tocqueville would have been also concerned about their fight against the right to abortion. I think that he would have cared also about their fight in these megachurches in favor of the death penalty. I think that he would have cared, Mr. de Tocqueville, also about their concern on weapons in free market and so on. It is not so simple. I love this idea of America associating itself. I love this idea of a civil society so vivid and so vibrant. But I don't think that those megachurches are the best way where you can see this vibrancy today, America.
Let's hear from these Americans. Tony's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
We're well. What do you think, Tony?
Well, I have to agree with this man because I grew up on the Indian reservation, and I saw the contradiction of wealth and poor, and I just think we're a contradiction nation. One thing's too extreme, one thing's to the extreme. Now I do cable installs in Kansas City, Missouri.
Yes, sir.
I go into million-dollar houses, and then four blocks away, there's the slums. I don't understand that. It's horrible to my eyes. We have a city in Louisiana that's totally destroyed, but we're going to Iraq and rebuilding that country. I don't understand that.
Tony, we've got it. We got the report right from the heartland there. Bernard and Levy, what about rich and poor in this country? What did you see?
I saw what Tony just said, of course, and I tried to see it methodically. These slums, these areas of poverty, very close. We are speaking in Boston today.
Mm-hmm.
You just cross a bridge and you go to Mattapan, you go to Dorchester, One mile away, not even, and it is an area of poverty.
Some not. I mean,
part of Mattapan are some streets where you have a real poverty. I'm sorry, in Los Angeles also, very close to Beverly Hills, you have some poverty. But what strikes me is that, but also the incredible generosity and the incredible solidarity of the American people. Look at Katrina.
Solidarity. Across the rich-poor line?
Yes, of course. Look at what happened in Katrina, for example. Mm. There was a disaster. This was really horrible. It was the fault of the Mother Nature, but also maybe a little the fault of the state and of the federal state, who did not do what had to be done.
Keep the levees built.
Keep the levees built, as the people of New Orleans asked since decades and years. But on the other side, when the survivors escaped from Louisiana, when they went to Texas, see the way in which the average people of Texas opened their arms, opened their houses, opened their schools, and opened their wallets to welcome the survivors of Louisiana. I am not sure that in France we should have acted this way. If such a disaster had come, a flood in Marseille, I don't feel that the people in Lille would have opened their heart in this way. And without speaking of what would have happened if the disaster had come in Germany and the people flowing through the border to France, we would have maybe kicked them back. So America, you have the two things. You have this poverty, 30 millions of poor, which is really unworthy of such a great and prosperous country. But you have also the real people, the average people, who show such a huge solidarity in these moments of crisis. Mm.
Bernard-Henri Lévy's book is American Vertigo. Tony, thanks for calling from Iowa City. We're at 800-423-TALK. Carl is calling from Groveland, Massachusetts. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Hi. Monsieur Lévy, you said a minute ago that you were hoping that the country would not be in a tyranny 10 years from now.
Mm.
It sounds like you're afraid of that. What shape do you think that tyranny could take?
I think what I try to explain is in American Vertigo, exactly in the spirit of Tocqueville on this point, is that the margin between democracy and tyranny is very small, is very thin. This is one of the points which I stress in the philosophical parts of the book. The book is a travelogue, but also with philosophical reflection. So I come back to this idea of Tocqueville, of the very thin margin between the two. What could be the form of the tyranny? Two forms. It could be the tyranny because of the law, of the pressure of the group against upon the individuals. The group can be majority, can be also the minority, and I give many examples of this risk in the book. And you have also today some political problem when you see that an administration takes the risk to wiretap the conversations of citizens and so on. It might be a problem. I don't believe that the tyranny is here. Far from it. I believe that the workings of the country, that the reaction and the reflexes of the people are so strong and so good and so sane that it will not go this way. But I think that we all have to be careful. In France, we had a risk of tyranny at the time of the Algerian War. We had it, and we did overcome it, of course, as you will, I'm sure.
And Monsieur Lévy, what did you learn from Sharon Stone and sex swinger clubs in San Francisco? How did these make your itinerary? What did you take away from them?
Because I wanted to meet average, plain American people, but also I could not prevent myself of meeting people who mean something for America. Sharon Stone means something for America. And moreover, I had a good political chat with her. And she told me, this is in the chapter of the book devoted to this moment, she told me about your current president, things which seem to me very accurate
like
and
what?
Very insightful.
Like what?
Like what? She told me this very funny thing that Mr. Bush never, in a few words, you had some presidents who were born to be president, like Mr. Clinton. At 5 years old, I'm sure some people could see that he was born to win in a way. You have some presidents who have been trained like horses to become president by their family, like Mr. John Fitzgerald Kennedy, who was trained to that. And what Sharon Stone said is that you have one who is the current one who was born to lose, who was absolutely not shaped to become a president, who was with the program of being a president.
But he did, and there he stands.
And he did twice.
Mm. Anna's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Anna, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I read a series in Atlantic Monthly. I found it very interesting.
The
very
series
insightful.
That this book was taken from, yes.
Yes, yes. It was very interesting. And I just wanted to quickly respond to Garrison Keillor's, being sort of angered by someone having the audacity to comment on American culture. I just find that, in general, Americans are really thin-skinned about anybody taking issue with anything politically or culturally, particularly when they're people from the outside. And I think this is to our detriment. There's just so much that isn't acknowledged. And, there isn't really kind of a culture of self-reflection or criticism here.
But when Garrison Keillor, you know what he kind of stands for in our cultural pantheon. He says the reader is fascinated and exhausted by Lévy's tedious and original thinking. I mean, do you laugh? Do you smack your forehead? Do you say, oh, Garrison, cut it out?
Yeah, I say, cut it out. What is the problem here?
there's a thumbs up from Anna. Bernard Lévy, what about Garrison's filleting of your work here? I mean, this is pretty tough stuff, and from a pretty prominent guy who stands for the heartland in some kind of media cultural sense.
For me, it's okay. You know, when you, ad- when you take the risk of doing what I did, the risk of coming to a friendly country and to see and to say really what you see, bright sides and dark side. And when you address your book to the American audience, as you know, it's not very frequent. This book is not published still yet in France, in America first. You take the risk of that. It is fair. It is a review. By the way, I find his review funny, well written, not so bad. It is the rule of the game. You have to be fair play at that. He write this, it is okay. The thing which I would like, this being said, I would like, of course, to answer to him, but to answer face to face, you know, what he wrote in the New York Times. I would like that he dares to come, or me to come. I can come to Minnesota.
Yes.
I made some journey in my life much more complicated than this one. I would like to go to Minnesota in front of him with a glass of French champagne or American beer. I don't care. And to speak man to man, frankly. This is a sort of challenge. I would be glad of that. I like confrontation, and I like the confrontation to go to the depth. I like that.
This is why
I wrote this book. It's a good reply, the reply of Garrison Keillor. No problem.
Ladies and gentlemen, you heard it here first. Bernard-Henri Lévy calling out Garrison Keillor. There's the challenge to share a glass of champagne or a beer in Minnesota and have it out man-to-man. Shane's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Shane, you're on the air.
Yes, I had two quick questions. One was, I was wondering if Tocqueville was concerned about class division in America, and I was wondering if you thought it had improved.
Class divisions, you say, Shane?
Yes, the rich versus poor class divisions.
Yes.
And the other comment I had is he said that he doesn't know if French people would come together as well in a crisis as we did in Katrina. My wife is from Normandy, and I was in France during the heat wave, and they had the same problem with a failure of government to respond.
A couple of years ago, the huge summer heat wave there, that a lot of people died.
Yes, and the government had a complete failure to respond, and the people came together and did what they could as much as they could, and I just wondered what the difference was between our response to Katrina and the French's response to the heat wave was, and I'll take my comments off the air.
Shane, we've got it, and thank you. Do you want to make some comparisons? Class distinctions, France versus U.S., response to tragedy, natural disaster?
Yeah. I think that America is, in this sense, a more democratic country than most of European countries. I don't want to say France only, but more democratic country. There is a sort of course, the class division exists. Of course, you have poverty, but you have these strong democratic feelings all over the society, which you feel in America when you really cross the country on grassroots level. You feel that, this sort of equality of conditions, which is not perfect. You are not a communist country, of course not. But you have less aristocracy than we have in Europe. As for the government, we have maybe an advantage in Europe. I think that our governments feel more than the American government that their task is, their duty is also to protect the citizens. There is the democratic feeling in America has one counter consequence, which is that charity, philanthropy, the way citizens taking care of the other citizens is a great thing, but in a way it leaves the government out of its duty. It is also the duty of a government. And not only in Europe, in America, you had this debate long in the past. The debate between the Federalist and the anti-Federalist tradition, the debate between Jeffersonian and Hamiltonian. I go at length on this political and philosophical debate, which belongs to the memory of America in my book. And maybe you went too far in the last decades on the way of government pulling away, the government putting himself aside of the real needs of the population. Maybe you will have, I think this is my friendly observation, you will have to go a few paces on the other direction in the following years. Mm.
Rick is calling from Boston. Hi, Rick, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. First, I'd like to say, Mr. Lévy, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I read your book on Daniel Pearl, and I would highly recommend that to anyone as a sort of investigative journalism cum spy thriller.
The Washington, the Wall Street Journal reporter killed in Pakistan, and Bernard-Henri Lévy wrote in depth about that. Yes,
it was a wonderful book. But and I read Garrison. I haven't read this book, and I did read Garrison Keillor's piece in the Times.
But I must say that listening to you this morning, the thing I'm struck by is if you're looking to describe America and give us some view as an outsider of America, but mostly you're telling us about mega churches and lap dances and Sharon Stone, you know, I don't see how that constitutes, from my view, America. And I would ask you, I guess, in this sense, the question that maybe you talked to Sharon Stone about, if you don't understand and haven't come to some serious conclusion about why Americans voted for President Bush, and you don't understand how President Bush sort of fits America, then I would submit to you that you probably haven't really gotten a very good view of America.
Rick, we've got it. Monsieur Levy.
I did not write a book about Sharon Stone, please. I answered to the question of Tom, but Sharon Stone is one page of the book, and there are many tens of pages about something else. For example, one thing which hurt me, which impressed me so much, the South of America. The South. I had the cliché when I arrived in Birmingham, in Montgomery and so on. I had the cliché in mind of the old Southern racist spirit of this part of the country. My great discovery, by meeting simple people, average citizens, not big stars, not big names. My book is not about big names. My great surprise was how the country has changed, how much progress had been done. I don't say that there is no longer racism in the South, of course, but I say that the process, the road which has been accomplished since 40 years between the dream of Martin Luther King and the death of his beloved widow 3 days ago, This path is incredible. It has the South, half of the country has gone from night to light.
But to Rick's question then, how do you, after your journey, after all your conversations, how do you understand the two terms now in the second term of George W. Bush? The choice of the American people, does it line up with what you saw? How do you understand it as a French visitor?
I think that there are two Americas, obviously, not only red and blue state. I think that this opposition is sometimes not so relevant. But of course, there are two Americas. Of course, there is an America who believes in the inheritage of the civil rights movement, of the Kennedy age, of the founding fathers and so on. And there is an America who is afraid of the future, who is afraid of the threats from outside, who is afraid for its own identity. And when you are afraid when you are taken by vertigo in front of your own identity, you may have some reactionary reflexes. You may have that. My conclusion in the book is that this is not the essential. My conclusion in the book is that this rightist and conservative wave might be less durable than we could believe. My conclusion is that it might be a rare, in a way. I know that Mr. Bush was elected with a big majority. It could a real majority.
The second time.
But maybe it is in a way a rare guard fight. Maybe it is the last fight of an old conservative America who knows that she has lost and who wants to deliver his last battle. The country has so deeply changed in its depth. Believe me, on the issue of races, on the issue of solidarity, also on the issue, for example, what I was talking about, the duty of the state about health, for example. I met so many citizens who believe that the health problem is one of the most prominent you will have in the next years in America, who are really conscious of that. So I am not so hopeless. On the contrary, I finish this journey full of hope. And American Vertigo, for me, is the continuation of my book about Daniel Pearl. The Daniel Pearl book was a book about an American martyr and hero. And this book, which is not a book about big names again and big stars, it is a book about average American people whom I believe my brothers, in a way.
I'm not so sure Bush voters would see themselves as hopeless. Jack, if it were our old Tocqueville himself coming back on this journey, if he could return and walk in those trails again, do you think we'd have something like American Vertigo or something else?
he might well see aristocracy represented by Bush. After all, I began talking about the election of 1828 between John Quincy Adams and Andrew Jackson, John Quincy Adams being the other president whose father was a president. And Mr. Bush, with his pedigree going back, I think, to the Queens of England. He's an aristocrat and bred to be one. And, of course, he fits the country. You can argue, and I think the data will argue, that America is headed more toward aristocracy now than ever before. Between 1950 and 1970, for every dollar earned by the bottom 90%, the top 0.01% earned $162. Between 1975 and today, for every dollar earned by the bottom 90%, the top 0.1% earned $18,000.
That's quite a ratio.
That is aristocracy. Oh, we're heading toward George Bush is the president, an aristocrat of this moment.
We'll see. Alion is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I want to ask him, how do you compare the racism that exists in France and the racism that exists in Europe?
Did you say racism? Racism, yes. Is that the word?
Yes.
Comparing the two. Yes. Bernard?
Racism is everywhere comparable and everywhere the same. What I would compare is the reaction of our two countries toward it. I believe that you did in the last 40 years a really great job, which we did not do. I am in my country the founder of SOS Racism. I think that what we achieved is a joke compared to what has been achieved in the 60s, 70s, 80s. And you see that when you go to Atlanta. You see that when you go in Tennessee. You see that when you go in Little Rock, Arkansas, and so on. Incredible, huge path. Why? Because of a pattern of citizenship, which is the American one, and which has the great virtue to articulate the two allegiance. You have a way in America to allow a citizen to be faithful to his origin and to become an American patriot, which is a really pretty good articulation, which maybe we have lost in France. And on this point, we should learn lessons from American model.
I want to ask you about anti-Americanism. There's plenty in Europe and France and I mean, around the world these days. You describe yourself as the anti-American. When this book is ultimately translated into French, let's say, and sold in France, I assume it will be at some point, how do you think the French will respond? Will they read in these pages and see an America to admire, or will they read about malls you describe as kind of mortuaries and obese Americans you describe?
Obese, no. I say the contrary. There is a cliché of America being a country full of obese. And I say precisely that there are no more obese in America than in France. And I add something else, that there is a metaphorical obesity, which is not the obesity of the bodies, but which is the obesity of the churches, of the banks, of the big companies, of the
mega,
campaign
the
budgets.
Big.
Mega.
So what will your countrymen see in this picture that you paint?
They will see. Number one, I'm not sure that they are so glad that this book is published in America before France. This is a sort of blasphemy in France. It is a sort, you know, we are a little touchy, like you are in America. We are pretty the same on this point. We too, French and American, believe that we have a sort of manifest destiny and so on. And the idea of a French writer offering his book first to an American audience is a sort
What's up
of
with that? Right.
crime of lèse majesté.
Yes.
Number two, I think that they will find the book too friendly for America. Yes, I strongly believe that. For example, there is this chapter at the end of the book, which might be malls and Sharon Stone. It is first of all a philosophical book with intellectual debate with your great American thinkers of today, with Fukuyama. There is a strong discussion
of
Fukuyama, end of history, about terrorism and state of affairs on this point. What is the situation of America and of the world in front of terrorism? Is Huntington right when he said that we are facing a clash of civilization?
Is it going
and
to win?
So
we've got half a minute. Will it win America any more friends in France, in Europe, or will they read this and say, oh, forget it?
I think that the French will find it too friendly. For example, on the question of empire, I discussed the idea of America being a new Roman empire. Mm. I think that this is not the right pattern to understand what is happening in this country. Frenchmen will disagree on this point. I believe, in a way, in one word, that American will find me too severe and French too friendly. That's the best situation for a free spirit and a French who loves America.
Well, we see a very American experience in your trail here, the trail of Tocqueville, pursued this time by Bernard-Henri Lévy. The new book is American Vertigo. Monsieur Lévy, thank you very much for being
thank
with us.
Thank you very much. I was glad to be here, Tom, again.
Jack, a last thought on Tocqueville looking on Monsieur Lévy.
Well, I think I'm going to go ice fishing on Lake Wobegon this afternoon.
The ice is pretty thick when it comes to this one.
That's right.
Say hi to Garrison. Remind him he's been called out. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.